This is Sheila Story at Mind Body Universe. Welcome today. My guest is Robert Rickover, who teaches the Alexander Technique. Robert, welcome.
Thank you.
Why don't
you tell us
about the Alexander Technique and what it is and what it does for people?
Sure. The Alexander Technique is a method that's been around for well over 100 years. And it's a little tricky to give a one or two sentence definition of it, but I would say it's a way that you can learn to redirect your own body, your mind body, to use it more effectively, to improve your posture, to improve the way you do things, whatever that is, whether it's working at a computer or sports activity or performing arts, whatever. It's a way of learning how to use your body as efficiently as is possible to do so.
Now, I've noticed, because I've been teaching yoga for a couple of years now, and I've noticed that often when, and that deals with mind-body
awareness,
mind-body integration and body awareness, when people think they're standing up straight, when they think they're standing with postural alignment, they're often not. It's like they can't really feel it. What feels balanced to some people, myself included. I mean, I found these little things when I first started practicing, you know, these little things that I was doing. I was holding my neck in a really bad way when I was sitting and all sorts of things like that. Is that kind of...
That's certainly very much something that we deal with in the Alexander Technique. I would say there are two pertinent things to say about that. One is, one of the discoveries that Mr. Alexander, that was F. Matthias Alexander was his name, made in the course of his own self-investigation, was that the information he was getting from his body about what he was doing, how he was standing, how he was speaking, and so forth, was wrong. And this came as quite a shock to him. He assumed, as I think most people do, that when they feel they're doing something a certain way, that's in fact what they're doing. Now, he, operating with very primitive technology by modern standards, basically sets of mirrors that he used to observe himself, found that when he thought he was doing one thing, he was in fact sometimes doing the exact opposite. So that's one reason why people may not be, in terms of posture, may not be standing all that well just because they think they are. The other reason, which is I guess related, is that there are ideas about proper posture that are around that for the most part are not very useful. The whole idea of telling somebody to stand up straight or to sit up straight makes a series of assumptions that, first of all, they know how to do it, and so all you have to do is tell them how to do it. And often, because of experiences growing up, experiences in school, and so on, people simply have never learned how to stand upright or sit upright with an easy upright posture. What they've learned how to do is sit and stand either in a slump or possibly the opposite extreme, sort of overarched back, lifting their chest, and sometimes alternating between the two. When one gets sufficiently uncomfortable, they'll switch to the other. But many of us have never learned how to just simply stand and sit in an easy, upright way.
Absolutely. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the history of the Alexander Technique, how he came to progress?
Sure. Alexander was a reciter. He lived in Australia in the latter part of the 19th century. His situation was he was very talented. He was a Shakespearean reciter. He used to give one-man recitations in an environment where there were quite large halls or auditoriums, but of course there were no PA systems. And in an attempt to project his voice to the back of the hall, he discovered, or people told him, that after maybe a half hour of his recital, he was gasping for breath. His voice became hoarse. And he was very dedicated to his craft, and after exploring every possible way of improving that situation, he went to vocal coaches, he went to doctors, he tried everything, and nothing really worked. He set about exploring and examining himself, which no one had ever really suggested he do before. And he set up a series of mirrors to observe himself. And over a period of several years, he discovered what he was doing that was causing the problem, which in fact didn't take all that long, a few months from what we can determine. But he also, what took him a long time was to figure out how to actually make a change in what for him were very deep-rooted habits of speech and posture.
I see.
Having accomplished that and going back on stage and being quite successful, he also attracted people who wanted to learn how he'd done it. And in fact, some of the very doctors he had been to earlier referred people to him. As his fame and reputation in Australia and also New Zealand grew, he was strongly advised to go to London, which was in fact the center of the universe as far as
sure.
people in Australia were concerned at that time. And he moved to London in the early 1900s and very quickly established a reputation initially with actors and musicians and other performers. Then later, within a few years, people from all sorts of backgrounds would come to him who had issues concerning their body of one kind or another, back pain or stiff shoulders, stiff necks, and so on. And he became quite well known very early on. He also made periodic trips to America. He taught in New York and Boston, and attracted a lot of very famous people who endorsed his work and wrote about it and wrote introductions to his books and so forth. And eventually he started training teachers in the 30s, and he died in 1955. The work has continued and expanded quite a bit since then to, at this point, there are probably, I would guess, around 3,000 or 4,000 teachers in the world. Curiously enough, the first person to sign up on his first training course was a woman from Lincoln, Nebraska.
Is that right?
Her name was Marjorie Barstow, and she had lived here all her life. She was born in Ord, Nebraska, but she lived here from the age of 2. And she came back to Lincoln and started teaching. And I met her in 1979 when she was 80 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
For a 2-week workshop, 6-7 hours a day.
I have to interrupt you right here because you said she was 80 years old. And I recently, there was a documentary that showed at the Ross Theater earlier in the year, Ballet Russe.
Oh, yes.
And the thing that I noticed is that they had all of these, like, 80 and 90-year-old ballet dancers.
And they looked good.
They were upright. They were lifted.
Yes.
They were fully present.
Yes.
They had an air, a command about them, and not at all like, you know, some of the more, you know, like a lot of people.
Which
you
normally associate with someone of that age. Yeah.
So was she like that when
Marge was, she was a relatively small woman, a short. She was probably, I'm guessing, about 5'2 or 5'3. Her face was, she looked 80, her face, mm-hmm. but if you were to see her from behind walking down the street, you would think it was a woman in her 30s.
Sure.
It was absolutely astonishing. Well, even more telling was that this first workshop we went to, it started right after Christmas, went for 2 weeks straight, 6-7 hours a day in the basement of Westbrook Hall. There were about 25 people there. And most of us, after 2 or 3 days of this, would go home and just crash because we were absorbing a lot of material.
Absolutely.
And we were making changes that we needed to integrate.
Now, you're talking about bodily changes.
Yeah,
you're
learning
about your own body at the same time you're trying to absorb this vast amount of material.
That's what we were doing. And Marge would, at the end of the day, want a party. and she was very unhappy if people didn't want to go out to dinner and go see a show. And when I say 6-7 hours a day, I mean every day, New Year's Day. I mean, we just went right through the whole 2 weeks. At the end of that, too, I was actually on a teacher training program in London at the time. And I was almost had to be poured onto the plane at the end of that 2 week period. So it left a huge impression on me, this lady. And I eventually moved here in part to study with her and do workshops for her here in the 90s.
So what can someone expect if they, I don't know, I mean, well, first of all, let me just back up a little bit. What will motivate someone to call you? I mean, what do you usually get? Do you get people that call up and say, I've got pain in my back, my neck, whatever it is?
That's one group, and that's maybe 50% of the people, 45 or 50%. Another group about the same size are people who are performers of one kind or another. Now, in my case, it happens that most of the performers I work with are musicians. Mm-hmm. Other teachers tend to work a lot with dancers and actors. It just, for whatever reason, I seem to attract musicians. Their concern may be the same as that first group. They may be in pain. But they have an added issue, which is that for their work, for the work of a performer of any kind, the quality of how they use their body, how they use their physical mechanism, has a direct impact on the quality of the product they're producing. So a violinist with a stiff shoulder is not going to produce the same quality sound as another violinist with the same talent who doesn't have that. And of course, all of those performing fields are pretty competitive. They all place, especially music, musicians, huge demands are placed on them physically. A lot of people think, you know, being an athlete is the most demanding physically, but mm-hmm. I would say no, it's being a musician, because you're performing the same movements over and over again, often 3, 4, 5 hours a day.
And you have to sustain attention.
You've got to be present. You've got to be present with the work. You've got to, you can't go on autopilot.
Right.
And you're doing the same basic movements over and over with very subtle variations. We talk a lot today about repetitive strain injury and carpal tunnel syndrome. These are words that are in our vocabulary. Interestingly enough, they weren't really in our vocabulary 20 or 25 years ago. We can thank computers and
Absolutely.
Keyboards for that. But musicians have always had these issues. They didn't have that terminology. But these are issues that musicians have faced from the beginning. A recent study showed that maybe 80 to 85% of all musicians, all professional musicians, play in pain.
Oh, wow.
Now, that's pretty astonishing
if
you think about it. So those are the two groups. There's a smaller subset, smaller group of people who simply want to learn about themselves.
Uh-huh.
They are interested in discovering how they function. I would say that's a very small group in terms of people who initially come. But some of the people who come for one reason end up staying for quite a different reason, or end up continuing lessons for that kind of reason.
Because they find it rewarding and gratifying to have
and
that.
And fascinating. Because you not only learn about yourself, of course you learn how people function. You start to observe other people, and you start to see patterns, and you get a kind of a deeper understanding of how human beings work on a physical level. And some people, like myself, end up getting so drawn to it that they devote 3 years to training to be a teacher.
I think I might be one of those, because the mind-body relationship is something that's intensely interesting to me. It's been my observation. Do you remember that movie? It was from the 80s. Road Warrior, it was a Mel Gibson movie. There was the bad guy in that movie. It was this big, muscular guy with this evil little person that was like sitting up on his shoulders, and he just had this sort of bucket over his face, and the evil little person on the shoulders was the one with the whip. I find that to be typical of, or symbolizes, you know, the mind-body relationship that most of us had, where the body's just treated like this big, dumb idiot, and the mind is sort of this little thing that's just kind of whipping it into, you know, making it bend to its will.
Yes, yes. I think that's a pretty good way of seeing how many people do approach their bodies. And, oh, I've got to go and do so many, lift so many weights or run so many miles. I don't really want to do it, but I know it's good for me. And it's a kind of a separating, an artificial separation. You know, the idea of mind and body being connected, we kind of take it for granted a bit today, although in some cultures, particularly in the East, I believe this has been well known. Certainly the people who developed yoga in India, I guess, is that where it originated? Or
They had this figured out like thousands of years ago.
They knew the two were connected, and I believe the Chinese have always had a pretty clear understanding of that. But when you talk about an outpost of the British Empire in Australia in 1890, the very thought that your mind might control, might relate somehow to your body, be connected with it that closely, was just not around. It wasn't around in Western culture. What Alexander discovered, and this, he didn't come to this with that this idea, but what he discovered in the course of his self-investigations and his working with other people was not just that they were connected. In his view, they were basically two aspects of exactly the same thing.
Aren't they kind of finding that out now? I mean, haven't they found out that there's actually memory coded into our cells?
Absolutely.
Our physical cells.
Absolutely.
Memory.
Absolutely.
So that kind of...
And he was very clear in his writing. He would say things in his books like, well, in this chapter, I'm going to use the word mind, and I'm going to use the word body. But I want it understood that when I use the word mind, I'm really just talking about the relatively more mental aspect of something. And when I talk about body, I'm talking about something that has more a preponderance of the physical. So if I'm sitting at a desk thinking about a project, obviously my mind is engaged, but it would be a mistake to think that my body wasn't engaged as well. Same thing, if I'm lifting really heavy weights in a gym, clearly my body is heavily engaged in that, but it would be a serious mistake to neglect the role that my mind has in directing how I do it.
So what can someone, when you begin working with someone, how does that process?
How does it work when someone comes for a lesson?
What can they expect if they come to you for a lesson?
Well, I should probably say it, preface it by saying they shouldn't expect a cure for all their ills. I'm not, we Alexander teachers are just that. We're teachers. We're not therapists. We don't diagnose illness. We don't promise to fix things. What we are interested in doing is helping people to learn how they can start to notice what their patterns are and how they can, if they so choose, change those patterns. We're all about process. We're not about, for example, saying to a student, well, you should do this kind of an exercise or you should do this or that. What we're interested in is whatever they do, whatever they've chosen to do in their lives, how can they learn to do it more effectively? And the actual teaching method is a combination of talking, verbal instruction, but also supplemented with some very gentle hands-on guidance. And the hands-on guidance is not manipulation or anything like that. It's to simply make clear what we're asking a student to do verbally, they're actually doing physically. That there's no ambiguity about it. I earlier we talked about telling people to sit up straight or stand up straight and assuming they knew how to do it. We don't assume someone knows how to do it. We will show them some possibilities and how they can direct themselves to those possibilities.
Does it involve, like, I've noticed that the body has its own kind of intelligence. Mm-hmm. And if you can get the mind to sort of like be quiet and stay out of the way, mm-hmm. then that sort of emerges, and then you're able to get like way more information from the body than you really knew was there or thought was there.
Right, and that's certainly true. And one of the things that we teachers emphasize, especially in the early lessons, is what do you notice? I'm constantly asking my students, well, what do you notice now? Because people often were simply not trained to pay that kind of attention to ourselves. We're trained to put our attention externally in the task that we're doing. And we're not really generally well trained to direct attention gently to ourselves. Well, what am I doing with my breathing right now? Am I breathing right mm-hmm. now? What's going on with my neck? Am I tightening it? Is it free? That sort of thing.
I think we tend to limit our experiences. Going back to what you said about being aware of mostly external, we tend to limit our experiences to what we can see and what we can hear. And the mm-hmm. other senses, as far as like, you know, body awareness or feeling or mm-hmm. sensation, kind of get pushed aside. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if we can kind of take the visual and the audio out of it, or just mm-hmm. kind of like know that we can see and hear things without reacting to them. Because when you become aware of perception, that's subtle.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But we don't, as teachers, we generally would not encourage someone to, for example, close their eyes during a lesson. One of the things that often comes up in lessons is the importance of how our heads and bodies relate. You know, our head weighs about 12 pounds, and it's poised right up at the top of our spine. And many of us tend to hold it in a position that's not balanced. And so as Alexander teachers, we want to get people to start to notice what's going on with the relationship of their head to their body and how that balance might change. And we certainly don't want to close off either the visual or the auditory information coming through, because a lot of balance information comes from your eyes and from your ears. And we all know about the inner ear canals and
sure,
so forth.
Yeah.
But our eyes also are a major source of balance information. So Alexander work tends to be very in the moment, in the real world oriented. Mm-hmm. We work with people in the activities they would work mm-hmm. with whenever possible. If a musician were to come to me for a lesson, I would urge them to bring their instrument if they can mm-hmm. the first lesson. If someone's a runner, mm-hmm. certainly within the first few lessons, we'll go out on the sidewalk and run. Well, I won't run, but
yeah,
they will run.
Sure.
And we'll see what they do when they run. Because sometimes the only way to find out what a person's habits of movement are for a particular activity is to observe them in that activity. They may have inadvertently picked up some idea of what they need to do to run, for example, to take that example, that doesn't actually appear anywhere else in their lives. It may mm-hmm. be quite specific to running. There also may be patterns that are specific to everything. Mm-hmm. The general tendency of people to tighten their necks, for example, when they
sure.
go into an activity is pretty general.
The other thing that I find is that, because I'm a computer person, and, of course, working on a newspaper copy desk, you get a little stress now and then. The thing that I've noticed that I find myself doing is I tend to, like, close my shoulders. I mean, this is not visual, I know, but if you could see me right now, I'm, like, hunching over, I'm breathing in, I'm bringing my shoulders together, I'm kind of curled in, and I sit there, and I, you know, and I type like that. And it's like you can't breathe. You can't even really breathe when you're like that, but that's our tendency.
That's a real common tendency. As I said earlier, there's another tendency that some people have. It's exactly the opposite. This sort of over-straightening or sometimes associated with, for example, the military or police. If that gets a better press, people visually like that better. But from a functional point of view, it's equally harmful to the slouch. Either one of those, if you can start to be really sensitive to that pattern to the point where you can catch it when it first shows up. And when it first shows up, it might not even be visible to someone looking at you. It might just be like almost a direction of compacting. And if you can catch that, and then very gently say, no, I don't want that.
Well, there is
it
that.
It can make a huge difference.
There is that military thing, you know. You see the Marine standing, the chin is pushed way back. That the back of the neck is supposed to have a nice little C shape.
Yeah, yeah.
And the way they do that, I mean, does the military know that they're...
Well, it's funny you should mention that. Alexander, at one point, was asked to be a consultant to the British Army. I believe in the 30s. And he found a recruiting poster that the Army had put out showing a sergeant major in the British Army up against a kind of a grid that would show his posture. He was stripped down from the waist up. And it was the most extreme example of standing up straight, you know, what you would see in a movie about an old army setting of someone way overdoing it, and this photograph had been used by the British Army as a recruiting poster, and Alexander, in fact, included
kind of like
that
the few, the proud guy, you know, standing there with the sword,
and he actually put that photograph in one of his books to illustrate this. And the point he made to the whoever he talked to in the Army was that if you want soldiers to look a certain way for parades and so on, if you wanted that look, well, you've got it. But if you actually want them to be able to march and fight effectively, this isn't going to work. Now, I think my sense is that in the military today, there are remnants of that. I don't think you would find anything like what you would have seen, for example, in the British Army of the 30s and 40s today. But if you look at honor guards or the Marines that are around the White House and so on, they do tend to stand a bit stiffly in that way. And maybe that's what people want as a visual, but it's not going to be real helpful if they end up taking that pattern into actual combat.
Sure, yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, Robert, this has been very interesting. Is there anything else that you would like to add to our discussion?
Well, I have a website that if anyone's interested in learning more about the Alexander Technique, it is at alexandertechnique.com. It's all one word, spelled pretty much the way you'd expect.
And it's a really good website, too. I've been there.
Oh, thank you.
It's quite comprehensive, lots of good information.
I've tried on that site to answer any question that anybody would have. And if there's a question that you still can't get an answer to, there are some email discussion groups and forums that you can log on to and get answers from teachers around the world. It's basically an international site. Also, I suppose I should give my phone number in Lincoln. It's 475-4433, and I'd be glad to talk to anyone who wants more information.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming and discussing the Alexander Technique on Mind-Body Universe. This is Sheila Story. Thank you.